The following contains strong language, violence, and nudity. It is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
Greetings, all my sponsors and sponsets.
So today we're going to talk about Angela, a Neil Gaiman creation.
Well, there's a bone of contention. It was always considered a co-creation between Neil Gaiman and Todd McFarlane. That was never really contested. It was the copyright that was contested.
Oh, okay.
This episode, we're actually going to be talking about Angela. And this goes back to our ninth episode, because I really wanted to cover a lot of Angela material in that episode, make it all about Angela. And so we went to the miniseries. But it's a little bit tricky in terms of continuity, because the Angela miniseries has happened between the last month's issue and this issue. So we're going to give you a little bit of a refresher on what happened in that miniseries.
In the Angela series, we're introduced into a world of angels, where all the angels are women, super hot, of every race. She's reading a manual that's basically
explaining... Well, you want to describe Angela?
A ginger goddess. A Wonder Woman body type.
Fit, but she's not like cut or anything.
So just Wonder Woman with red hair and really dark goth eyeliner.
Kiss.
No pupils.
And she's also got the headband with great big eagle wings on either side of
very
it.
Very Thor-ish.
But also recalls an angel's wings, because she's Angela. She wears earrings that are the spawn symbol.
Those are trophies of spawns, which is stupid, because apparently when you kill a spawn, they turn into a fucking token.
They tell you what a hell spawn is, that they're creatures that are generated once every 50 to 100 years.
It takes a lot of power to generate them.
Right, and they're given a large but not infinite amount of power. So the reason why the angels are hunting the hell spawn, and particularly trying to get at them when they're young, is to prevent that power from returning to the male bulge, the area from which the hell spawns generate. And when they're young, they're dumb, they're full of cum, they're also somewhat more altruistic. It's encouraged for the angels to take them on before they know what they're doing. You have to kill the bearer of the spawn. The hell spawn is the human host, but you also have what they call the carapace, which is somewhat intermittently referred to as a spawn itself. And the carapace is the shape-shifting suit. After you kill the host, you then have to kill the symbiote, parasite, whatever we want to call the suit, and that's where the token derives from. The token is actually the remaining portion of the suit that survives.
The lance is seen as the most dangerous way to kill a spawn.
Well, no, it's the only way to kill a spawn, because you have, after you've weakened or destroyed the human host, the suit is still emanating a scrambler that prevents you from actually killing the carapace itself. Mm-hmm. And so you have to get in close range to overcome that disturbance and then blast the suit to kill the suit. With this, you got like this energy rod at the bottom of the spear that destroys the suit.
Angela comes to Earth, and apparently on the planet Earth, we have a game warden, Gabrielle.
These two obviously have an antagonistic relationship, and obviously the white-haired woman is some big muckety-muck at a corporation, because they're trying to deny Angela entry, and she's like, no, I'm Angela. I'm getting in here.
Angela.
Hey, you can't.
I know she's in, and she's gonna see me.
Hey!
How dare you burst into my office like this?
Why wasn't I called about the hell spawn?
What are you talking about?
You've had me deliberately taken out of the loop.
Angela, really?
Save it, Gabrielle. He's mine.
You're not the only hunter in the universe, Angela.
I've taken out the last two hell spawns, and I want this one.
You realize it's this kind of behavior that makes it difficult to trust you.
If there's one thing I do well, it's hunt. A lot of people don't like that, including you, but that's not gonna stop me.
Go through the proper channels.
Those channels lead to you. I'm here. I'm talking to you, Ambassador. What about the permit?
Denied.
How long are you going to have it in for me, Gabby? A century? Two?
Follow appropriate protocol, and maybe I'll reconsider.
Just try and keep me out of this, Gabby.
Goodbye, Angela.
Pulls out this little, I guess, magic pill or
ball. It's glowing like BB.
Which is apparently their hunting permit. And Angela decides to go ahead and start hunting the spawns. Angela finds Al. They begin the battle. At one point, she believes she's already destroyed Spawn. All of a sudden, Spawn's arm reaches out and grabs her and then yanks her into the suit. He's choking her. I guess at the last moment, he releases her. He lets her go because she's scared shitless. And she runs like a bat out of hell, shoots out of the suit. But she forgets her lance, which is a heavily weapon. Spawn finds Angela's lance. He picks it up, he's looking at it, and Spawn's like, there's a button here. Touches the button, he's automatically teleported somewhere else.
And I guess he's in, I don't know, man, like a writer's world? The book, to me, was commentary on how comic book writers are treated. It really didn't feel like a Spawn start. It's him standing on his soapbox and preaching in comic book form.
Before he starts, with Spawn in his alley, waking up from the dreams he's been having about Angela and aardvarks and everything. You're reintroduced to Bobby, the main homeless dude that he hangs out with.
And Boots.
The Angela series actually has a lead-in within Spawn number 23. 26. And in that story, Spawn is once again talking with Cagliostro, who tells him, you're about to disappear and deal with a little intermission right now, and I'll get back to you afterwards. And Spawn's like, what are you talking about? He gets teleported to some frou-frou place like in France or something.
It's supposed to be a pocket universe between Earths or some shit like that. Like, we get a real weird dimensional thing. And he's introduced to
Gabrielle,
who I feel is upper management when it comes to angels,
who's sitting at a table drinking wine and eating strawberries, invites him to do the same.
She asks him if he remembers Angela, which of course he does. He talks about their encounter. She does ask him more about the lance. And he talks about how he touched it and it teleported him. But she said, no, it did something like it supercharged him or some shit.
And he explains, I don't know what happened to the staff. I touched it. I disappeared. I went into this weird dream and then I woke back up again and the lance was gone. And she said, that's not remotely what happened, but you're sure you don't know what happened with the lance? And he's like, nah, thank you very much. You've been very helpful, Spawn.
Well, the whole thing is she wants to know where the lance is. Because apparently, because she lost, that's a big no-no. Because she alludes to that, you know, she can't wiggle her way out of this one.
And then he gets teleported back to Spawn Alley and Cagliostro.
Angela's then taken into custody. They're referring to her as a traitor because apparently she hunted without a license, which is a huge offense. And that's
or Gabrielle's claiming that she didn't have a license.
Well, true.
That she never saw the hunting permit. So immediately Angela knows it's a frame job.
Her friends, the angels, decide that they're going to try and prove her innocence by talking to Al, the Spawn, but his witness. Decide to teleport him to heaven, which is called what?
Elysium.
But it's a city in heaven. And his suit is reacting to being there. It doesn't like being here. It's reacting to all the goodness in the air.
It's the enemy.
Like, it's creating these spikes on his body, which is kind of weird. And they say, look, we need you to testify on Angela's behalf. So he's like, sure, I'll do it. They're going to, I guess, yeah, to the trial. At which point we get there and they're interviewing Gabrielle and she's talking about how Angela just showed up, didn't have permission, just went straight to hunting.
Gave her lance to the Hellspawn.
Yeah, I'm trying to make her sound like a traitor. That it was all a ruse, that she actually was trying to give him a weapon and painting her the villain that's betraying all of them. So she presents Al Simmons to the court. As soon as she shows up, suit goes full Spawn, trying to protect him because I guess he's surrounded by it in a courtroom full of angels. The suit goes crazy. Immediately the judge says, guards, kill it. She goes in there to defend him, to help him escape. They're jumping around,
fighting their way through this celestial city.
As they're dropping, she's telling them to teleport them out. Sharpshooter angels aiming weapons at them. And as they teleport, one of them takes a shot and I believe hits the suit, right? Or hits the cape.
Yeah, there's a bit of cape floating and everybody assumes that they're old, that they're both
dead. Disintegrate. Yeah, they're dead. They teleport to hell.
Angela and Spawn get it on.
That creature tells them that, you know, there's a gateway out of here, but there's two armies battling. They've been battling for 2 weeks now and the war should die down in about a week. And I was like, fuck that. We out of here.
Then they start bickering with each other.
She takes a sword. He takes an axe. They're hacking away. And because they jumped through the portal, each of them go back to their original beginning. Angela sent back to heaven. So Angela decides, I'm going to go back to Earth. I'm going to confront Gabrielle. Puts a sword to her head. She goes, you're going to confess. She alludes that whenever Spawn touched the lance, he was teleported somewhere. And when he was teleported somewhere, all records of her arrival disappeared automatically. Any proof that she was there to hunt was gone as well. And so she took it as an opportunity to get rid of Angela. There was no real motivation except she's hate and jealous. And then you find out that Angela had a tape recording on her. Send in the tape to the authorities. As she's done, she's not going to return to heaven. She's going freelance. Then we get to the end of the book where another angel is confronting Gabrielle about saying how the tape arrived. It's showing that she lied and that she has to go speak to the bosses. There's going to be some big changes.
Since we didn't really address Greg Capullo when he came on to Spawn, the ongoing series, or even during the Angela miniseries, I wanted to give him a minute by reading through some material from Wizard Magazine number 39, cover dated November 1994, interview conducted by Henry T. Colonna III, titled Spawn and Ground. Capullo didn't get his start with Image, though, and his interest in comics is far from a recent development. As a kid, I always wanted to draw superheroes, he recalls. Throughout his childhood, his mother would find his Batman and Robin drawings. However, he did not start considering comics work seriously until his early to mid-20s, when he began plying his artistic talents in commercial advertising for many national campaigns. I did stuff for General Electric. That's probably the biggest thing people would know. In 1987, Capullo took the opportunity to produce his own horror story and get his work published for the first time through Fantico, an independent publisher. Fantico had a store in downtown Albany, New York. I wasn't even aware that they published comics. Two friends of mine knew this guy there and brought me over there, and I became slave labor. Capullo plotted, penciled, inked, and lettered a horror title, Gore Shriek. Even though the experience he gained was certainly helpful, the publishing deal Fantico offered him didn't do much for his wallet. I got $40 per page, penciled, inked, and lettered. I thought the money sucked. I was working way too hard for the amount of money I was getting paid. He broke into the mainstream at Marvel Comics when colorist Tom Vincent recommended him to editor Craig Anderson. They needed an artist for What If Volume 2, Number 2, What If Daredevil Killed the Kingpin. Capullo then worked on occasional Marvel one-shots and was finally hired to draw the monthly Quasar full-time in 1990, which he did for nearly 2 years. During that time, Capullo managed to fit X-Force Annual No. 1 into his schedule. When plotter-penciler Rob Liefeld left the ongoing X-Force title, editor Bob Harris remembered Capullo's work on the annual and hired Capullo as Liefeld's replacement. While he enjoyed Quasar, Capullo often dreamt of opportunities such as X-Force. Quasar was fun. Any character that you pick up and are able to put some of your own interpretation into is going to be interesting to you. But switching to a much more popular book where the royalties go way up makes you much happier. X-Force was a lot more fun, with a lot more action. During Capullo's tenure on X-Force, Todd McFarlane called him up with the opportunity to draw, interestingly enough, Violator, of which Capullo wound up drawing the third issue almost 2 years later. Todd basically liked my work, Capullo says. I don't know if, at the time, he knew how dependable I was. He may have heard through the grapevine, because he's got eyes and ears and arms that reach far and wide. He tells me it's rare to find somebody who's got talent and is dependable. Usually it's one without the other. It's I suck, but I'm super dependable, or I'm brilliant, but good luck at seeing work. At the time of Todd's offer, however, Capullo felt safe and content at Marvel, calling X-Force this ultimately cool gig that most guys would kill for. He was also apprehensive about joining a fairly new company, which he didn't know much about. Even though Todd was making a deal that you can't refuse, I was conservative and really being careful. It took me a while to get discouraged at Marvel before I finally said, hey Todd, I'm willing to do something with you if you want to, and luckily he wanted to. Although artist Bart Sears had already taken Violator, written by Alan Moore, McFarlane had some other ideas on how to use Capullo's talents. Needing a break from Spawn, McFarlane asked him to work on the successful Spawn number 16 through 18 for him, and brought in writer Grant Morrison. More recently, Capullo took over the third and final issue of Violator, intended to be penciled in full by Sears. It appeared that Sears was taking a lot of time with the first two issues, even though Sears claims he was, at first, under a no-deadline stipulation, and was replaced when McFarlane got hot for a deadline. Capullo discusses at length how much he was censored at Marvel, both self-censorship through his understanding of the comics code, but also being redrawn at the bullpen when he would feature too much gore, or the fact that he used to draw her in the Quasar comic with a bikini, and they'd go in there and give her a more old-school bathing suit. He figured that the book could use some sexing up that needed all the eyes it could get. Marvel clearly felt otherwise. He also talks about how Marvel editors like Bob Harris had helped to improve his artwork, but really on a panel-by-panel basis, where working with Todd McFarlane had really opened him up as an artist, and that his work had improved overall with Todd's oversight. He talks about being influenced by action-oriented directors, particularly Jim Cameron from movies like Aliens and Terminator 2. He also talked a little bit about creator-owned comics from Image, of which at this point he hadn't really produced any, but he does point out, I am partial creator of Anti-Spawn. I don't own any copyrights to that, but I don't have a problem with that. At Marvel, you did not own a copyright, but they took everything from you lock, stock, and barrel. I understand that Todd owns the copyright so that he does not have to always ask for permission to use a character, but he compensates you well. Capullo goes on to talk about how he prefers artists over writers. In particular, he notes that he'd lost interest in the Hulk after Dale Keown left, despite Peter David's remaining on the title for many years afterwards. He specifically points out that he can read a bad comic drawn by Barry Windsor Smith because of nothing else, he can still look at the pages. But even with somebody like Neil Gaiman writing a comic, if the art's bad, he just can't stand to look at it. He cites among his favorite artists John and Sal Buscema and Gene Colan, as well as John Romita Jr., John Byrne, and the Image Gang. Capullo points out that one of the reasons why he left Marvel was his frustration with colorists, who he recognized didn't get royalties and probably had to hustle for as much work as they could get, but they still wouldn't get the details right on costumes he was designing. Capullo had another viable reason for finding his job at Marvel frustrating. After the Image defection, it seemed that Marvel became very reluctant to promote any of its individual creators. The thing I felt was, I could have used some more promotion for my company to get behind me and push for me, because I'm trying to make their book the best it can be. They had changed the way they thought of things because of the Great Exodus. They felt, if we promote this guy, he'll just get too big for his britches and leave. But then they were caught between a rock and a hard place with a person like me, who was willing to stay. If we don't promote him, he'll leave. It was kind of like a damned if you do, damned if you don't. And they chose don't. Just prior to Capullo's decision to leave Marvel, the company finally began to offer him creator appearances at conventions and stores. Unfortunately, at that point, I had already started dialogue with Todd, and my mind was pretty much made up, because I was tired of bitching. He goes on to talk about how he has no animosity toward Marvel, and in fact, one day he'd have liked to have gone back and worked on Fantastic Four, more to bring it back to the heights it had experienced under John Byrne. But he also noted that he wasn't a writer, and so they need to bring one in for him to do his best work on a title like that. He talks about being intimidated by Neil Gaiman, but after Gaiman responded well to his design sketches for the Angela miniseries, they hit it off and he stopped fearing the guy. He also noted that he did not get written scripts for Angela, that Gaiman felt that he would be more unfettered if he recorded his ideas onto audio cassette. He would just describe what he wanted into a tape recorder and Coppola would realize that. He alludes to a new relationship between Angela and Spawn that he felt would reverberate in the ongoing series, and that he's happy that he's going to finally get to ink his own work, beginning with the Angela miniseries. After Angela, Coppola will return to pencil Spawn once more from McFarlane, whose wife is due to have another child. Coppola quickly clarifies that McFarlane will not leave the book, far from it. We're going to be teaming up on a regular basis. We'll both be doing art for Spawn. As for who's doing what, we'll leave it a mystery for now. He references the missing issues, 19 and 20, that he was going to do to help fill in the gap in McFarlane's schedule. And he talks about how he'd really wanted to do a Ripclaw miniseries that had been offered to him by Mark Silvestri, but ultimately he had taken Todd McFarlane's job first and wasn't able to do the miniseries, that he did provide a Ripclaw pinup for one of the Top Cow source books. After Angela, Coppola has ideas for his own characters, but right now he is content to take each day in stride. With his continued exposure in Spawn and his collaboration with McFarlane, and just a few years, the name Greg Coppola could very well become a household name within the comics community. I always said right from the start, I'm not going to stop till I get to the top, and it looks like I'm going that way.
I can't believe this crap's been going on without me.
Hey, sweetie, didn't I see you in a magazine? Got a boyfriend, Beaver Treat? Somebody to lick away your day? I can do that for you, baby. You want me to show you?
Yeah, show me. Good hunting's where you find it.
Hunting? Oh, we got ourselves some kind of sports babe.
Sorry about this.
Oh, don't apologize, baby. It's all our fault. But it's gonna be fun. For us.
I don't think so.
After the enormous success of the Angela miniseries, a one-shot special edition was produced in 1995, simply titled Angela No Number. My understanding and vague recollection is that the book was not initially offered for direct sale. Instead, it was a retailer incentive tied to orders of Spawn number 32. As I remember it, every retail account got one copy of the version with Angela alone on the cover, and then you received a copy with Pirate Spawn on the cover for every 25 copies of 32 ordered. For instance, I think my first shop ordered about 50 copies per issue, and the second shop I worked at, upwards of 100 copies. So between these two shops, there'd have been about two Angela covers and about six Spawn covers. Both are rare, but it explains why my comic shop sells one for $175 and the other for $24. Shit. Yeah, despite it being a throwaway story. The story is called Ocean of Evil, Vessel of the Doomed. It's a 16-pager by Bo Smith and Brad Gorby with Chance Wolfe and Jason Gorder. It was dedicated to Neil Gaiman, co-creator of Angela.
So the story starts out with a woman walking through a alley, which tends to be a very Spawn moment, apparently for women in the Spawn universe, and she's accosted by three men. They begin to rob her, and then I'm assuming decide to rape and kill her from the dialogue level that I remember reading.
Safe assumption.
So they're dragging her into a building. A homeless guy wakes up. One of the guys kicks him back down. They go in the building. She's kind of smiling because you get a sense that this is a setup. They're all just freaking out because she's got, you know, a gold Rolex and credit cards and cash, and, you know, apparently she is very attractive, and she's smiling because she says something about her knight will soon appear, or her shiny knight.
Just
will soon
wait
appear.
Until my knight appears. This song will have all new lyrics. And by the way, I'm deeply uncomfortable with how the black guy's drawn throughout this story.
Well, again, read it this morning. This is all coming from memory, so I'm pretty proud of myself. Bond then pops up and starts yelling about, you know, we've discussed, you know, these are the rules, you know, my alley, my rules, da da da. The gentleman jumps and does a karate kick, which is then thrown off. The big guy's told to go beat him up, and apparently Spawn beats him up with a fucking tire iron in his chains. There's
that
a scene where the black guy's got the chains wrapped around his throat and he's beating up the other guy with a tire iron. And that's when Angela kind of, you know, laughs it off and appears and starts talking to Spawn. So I'm assuming this is after the issue where they are in a cave or something, because they talk about being alone.
See, that's why I wanted to cover this issue. We jumped from our Spawn number 9 coverage with the debut of Angela to the miniseries. We've caught up to when the miniseries was actually published and when it starts interacting with the Spawn book.
Okay. Angela's talking about how she's been hunting spawns for generations and how, you know, Al's just a little different. There's something different about him. And she's talking about something about Bible thumpers. And maybe that was the reason why the spawns had a different effect and how he's a little different. And he's going back to his, you know, true blue song, I Did It for Wanda. And she starts talking about how she had an interaction with Cutthroat Spawn. And then Shimmer Me Timbers, our next scene, we're on a ship and there's a pretty badass one-eyed fucking Crenshaw looking spawn guiding the boat, and there's like goblins around him, and it's very like GOP attack.
Well, I love that he's got his patch is basically the Punisher symbol with a chain, and that's his eye patch.
Doesn't he have like a big tattoo of the spawn symbol on his chest too?
Indeed. Well, similar. Yeah, it takes and like very part of how
she played the daughter of a queen to be kidnapped, and like there's some royal guard with his head cut off, and how
I love that the angle of the shot is so you're looking down his throat hole. From the severed body, the body with the severed head.
And so she's talking about how, you know, they were raping and pillaging the oceans, and they're just like, I'm reading and I'm immediately like taken to fucking Davy Jones from the fucking Pirates of the Caribbean, like that wooden ship, and it's all deformed, and all the pirates are deformed, and so I kind of assume that I assume that feel to it. So it seemed kind of cool, Pirate Spawn, and you know, she's playing the damsel, and then she. Pulls out her sword, or she mutates to Angela, and she's talking about how she's cutting limbs and chopping them up and how their carcasses are hitting the ground. Now, I did find it quite entertaining the way she kills the spawn, where apparently she keeps puncturing holes in them and his ectoplasm or whatever is like leaking out of him and it's weakening him. Did I read that right?
I think so.
Because she talks, like, they show where she's like puncturing his thigh and she's hitting him from the side, and you see like, you know, his ectoplasm, and she's kind of draining him of his power.
It's a little like she's carving a turkey at points.
Kind of, yeah. And then it's kind of cool where she talks about like his true self came out, and it's this deformed spawn head with like spikes and shit. And she's talking about how like she cuts off the head, and all of a sudden the water, you know, the water that was turbulent during the first few scenes is now calm. The sky's clear. All the demons are off the ship. They're dead, or their bodies are like, I guess, what does she refer to them as, like deflated or something like that? Like their spirits have gone back to hell, and she's vanquished this hell spawn. Kind of like that. She's just kind of telling Spawn about how she killed Cutthroat Spawn.
She says, like I said, it was easier then. Good was good, bad was bad, black and white, just like a newspaper, easy to read. But Al, you're a hard one to read. Still very flirtatious, because we did confirm that there was sexing in that miniseries, and so it seems like she's ready for round two and he's holding back, which is a different dynamic than usual.
Apparently Wanda wasn't that important that time, I guess.
For some reason, she gives him a bracelet, that she takes it off her wrist, so it must be a golden bracelet, and I don't know if anything ever becomes of that. She is not the damsel in distress in the story. That person, I guess, got rescued, and she appears at the on top of the mast and comes down and starts chopping the hell out of her.
I thought she was playing possum, like she let them kidnap her so she could get to him, because I thought that was the whole point of this one, where she played the damsel. So Spawn,
I think you just conflated the two events. Is what happened is that
are you sure? I'm pretty sure. Are you sure?
I'm looking at the book. The lady is a dark haired woman who's still tied by chains to the mast, and at the top in the sightseeing position, Angela's looking down on them. So
I just assumed she was like using the same technique to draw Al. Okay, my bad.
Have you ever had any experience with these creators before?
No, the art was horrible.
I thought the art was okay. Gorby and Bo Smith had made their bones as publishers on Eclipse's Parts Unknown, which was sort of a grindhouse alien type story about like kind of rapey aliens, which were a thing in the 80s that we kind of got away from going into the 90s. So I did notice that Angela was a lot more hippie in this story than she usually is, but it definitely also had that grindhouse quality. There was a little bit of a canon, like this is sort of like Cannon's spawn, because they go to fucked up Charles Bronson death wishy places with some of the depictions we're seeing in here. And again, just like the overwhelming rapiness throughout the story is present, but I thought it was okay for what it was. I do have to admire McFarlane's restraint though, because as I recall, Angela debuted around 93 or so, and here we are in 1995, and this was around the same time they were going to come out with the miniseries as well. So he was able to sit on Angela for a couple of years, just waiting for Neil Gaiman to come back to her and do the miniseries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these days, if somebody had gotten the kind of attention that Angela got that early on, they'd be putting her in her own book immediately. But
oh, yeah, she was hot, dude. I remember people buying the issues like crazy.
Well, it's like the market was beginning to contract pretty around the same time she was debuting. And like the last big speculator bubble in comics were the Bad Girls, and Angela was 100% on the vanguard of that, right? You remember she was like one of the first of the hot female characters where all of a sudden they were on the Wizard top 10 lists and stuff.
I just remember her figure always going for a large amount of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was short pack too, which probably helped.
I just remember always going to shops and like most spawns were like between $10 and $12 and she was always in the $20 range. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why? Like, it's, but it was, again, Angela was hot. There was always those cool scenes of her, like, you know, wearing the Spawn emblems on her. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's basically just a Valkyrie. That's all she is, with a fucking black mask on. She's just a Valkyrie with a black mask. She looked cool. I did like the aspect of, like, the angels had that look. I mean, they're fucking Xena warrior princesses, mm-hmm. basically. There was her, and I'm trying to think of the other. There was a lot of, like, wasn't there a lot of independent female characters?
Lady Death around, like, Dawn was blowing up at that point in time.
Remember Dawn was hot. You had
Dawn, Vampirella.
What was that? Something Girl by Campbell.
Oh,
by
Danger Girl. That was a little Danger bit later,
Girl.
Though.
Yeah, Danger Girl. You had all those characters. Don't know any of the name of those characters. I remember they all just look out of a fucking G.I. Joe comic book, but
yeah. Well, you remember, like, the market's contracting, the Bad Girl thing hits, and all of a sudden, everybody has a slew of Bad Girl titles. You know, everybody was putting the stuff out, and for a while, they were selling, so that really was the last big speculator bubble where you had something that actually did have an impact on the market. And I think that Angela had a special cachet because she brought in those Vertigo people, so she had a little bit more of a respectability sheen to her that most of the other ones didn't have. Mm-hmm. When the guy who's like buddies with Tori Amos is doing a comic book, you're going to bring in a different audience, you know? And actually, I think that what happened, I think that the Angela action figure is what fucked shit up. My vague recollection of reading the court documents and stuff, I think what had happened is that McFarlane and Gaiman had a gentleman's agreement, you know, kind of a handshake deal. Obviously, they had different perspectives of what the parameters of that was. And then when those figures started coming out and Neil was like, where's my money? I think one of the big differences between Neil Gaiman and Alan Moore is that Moore's a guy who just can't deal with the business part of it, and he's very principled, and so if he's unhappy, he just won't work with you anymore and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think Gaiman's much more of a fuck you, pay me kind of guy.
Respect.
Yeah, he makes sure he gets his money, and when he saw that they were making these action figures, he wasn't getting a cut, that's when shit got real between the two of those guys.
Yeah.
So, and I had at least
get the last laugh, because Gaiman sold it to Marvel. Like, Angela now is canon to Marvel.
You know, here's the thing. At the time, because I was clearly team Gaiman versus McFarlane just by nature, I felt like it was Todd causing all the problems, and Todd should have just worked shit out with Gaiman. And then now that I'm more of an Image guy, I tend to want to favor Todd a little bit more, because yeah, Todd handled things really badly, and the guy, if he was going to be a good businessman, he should have put shit down on paper, and that would have solved all these problems. But also, if he just fucking surrendered Miracle Man and not been a dick toward, because he was pulling all kinds of bullshit, dropping boxes of shit off at Gaiman saying, here you go, here's some negatives, this is all I'm going to give you, that kind of stuff. I think they both got to be big swinging dicks, and they both got to be assholes, and I think ultimately became like a spite lawsuit. And I think Gaiman just got sick of paying the lawyers, and so if both these guys hadn't been assholes, we would still have Miracle Man being put out with artistic credibility, and now it's owned by Marvel, and nothing's ever going to be fucking done with Miracle Man because of that, because a big corporation that's owned by Disney is never going to do shit with the Miracle Man property. So I think it fucked over creators.
That means my individual issues are worth money now. Goddamn reprints kill the price of my collection, man.
But they fucked up the reprints,
Alan
right?
Moore shit, dude. Trust me. When I see them do reprints of shit like that, I'm like, fuck, they just killed my books.
Yeah.
So that's fine, dude. One day when I croak and my kids sell, I own like almost all of that Miracle Man shit.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine by me.
And I'm bummed out too, because Angela was such a big character in the 90s, and now she's just like a third tier Marvel person who pops up in Guardians of the Galaxy.
I love the fact, dude. I haven't kept up with Marvel stuff with her that much, but apparently she's Odin's like love child,
right?
And she's kind of like the badass, like Thor's kind of like, whoa, who are you? And she's like, you know, I'm your sister and fuck all y'all kind of thing, because like I didn't get all of the attention that y'all did. Again, I haven't read that much about her, but I did read a little bit about it, and I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool. Like, yeah. I do like the fact that she's the fuck you kind of chick.
She's a little bit like Hela from the movies as opposed to the comic books.
Yes. Okay, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
But and I think last thing she was in was maybe as Guardians of the Galaxy, where they were, yeah, were doing a hybrid thing. But she hasn't had a lot to do in recent years, so that's kind of a bummer.
Oh, they'll bring her back. Some UB writer will see her and come up with some great story, and she'll that's kind of what I like. I do like the fact that sometimes a the characters do get a little cold, and then somebody has a new take on them and just gives it new life, and then they start talking about, like, you know, oh, you know, here's some Easter eggs from the series from the past. I kind of like that stuff. They remember the past, but they take it in a new direction. Mm-hmm. I don't like when the characters are like, I think that it's best for her, like, to have a cooling off period. Mm-hmm. And I mean, fucking who knows, dude, at the end of Love and Thunder, dude, all of a sudden Angela makes an appearance at the end. That would blow me the fuck away. Jane Foster's there and she's the Thor and fucking Angela's like her sidekick or some shit. I'd be like, oh, that's the ultimate fuck you to McFarlane right there.
Well, remember when they
Angela
were
in a Marvel movie?
Remember when they were casting the first Guardians of the Galaxy and everybody thought Kieran Gillen was going to play Angela instead of Nebula?
I didn't know that.
You didn't remember that?
No, I didn't remember that.
Yeah, that was a big speculation because you got a redheaded chick. She must be Angela. And then they paint her blue and shave her head.
I'm telling you, dude, if they put Angela in Love and Thunder, that is the fucking ultimate fuck you right there. Like, your movie, we're going to put her in a pretty much $1 billion movie, you know, and she's in, I don't know.
Man, if McFarlane is already, like, thirsty for a crossover between movie Spawn and Venom, how much more of a hard-on would he have to get Angela in the mix as well?
The thing is, though...
It won't happen. It'll never happen because Sony could potentially work with McFarlane.
Remember when you were talking about how, like, the Spawn movie, this, and I told you Todd is going to fuck it up. He's going to fuck it up. I already know he is.
Well,
because I respect him because he really is that kind of guy where he's like, if I see it, I do it. It gets done. I respect that. The problem is hubris is a motherfucker. Mm-hmm. Hubris is a motherfucker, and Todd doesn't seem to understand that. Mm-hmm. He definitely fucking rake. What is it called? A rake step? Where like he constantly walks into a rake and hits himself. Okay. He does that shit with the fucking baseballs. He does that with the Spawn movie. Now, right now, he's doing a lot of cool figures for DC, but it's, I don't know, man. Like, I mean, he definitely is the toy master. I've bought quite a few of his toys, and they're well done. They look great. They're on my shelves. I bought a Spawn figure just because we're fucking Spawnometer. I have a fucking Spawn figure, and it looks fantastic. Fucking hurts you if you grab him because his fucking studs are real. Like, they fucking hurt. So, looks great. I don't know where I'm going with this.
You've managed to bridge Sideshow Collectibles and Sideshow Bob. So that's something.
Hey, Kelsey Grammer's a goddamn American treasure.
Also Republican.
That's all right. They're not all evil. And I get it. Not all Nazis fucking goose stepped. Some of them kind of stood on the side and clapped gently. I mean, come on. So, no, not right. But there's, and you know what I'm saying, dude. Like, Todd, yeah. he definitely gets shit done, but he just fucking hits. Sometimes, his fucking hubris is just too much sometimes, mm-hmm. dude. Like, I watch some of the stuff when he comes out with a new toy, and I'm just like, I don't know. I mean, his shit is cool.
All I know is Renner's off making Hawkeye, and COVID has happened, and that movie wasn't looking like it was getting great traction to begin with. I just don't know if it doesn't just go away. You know, it might just Spawn the movie. I don't know that it doesn't just go away.
No, someone's gonna make it.
Man,
I think the problem is Todd thinks he should get $100 million budget, and it's like, dude, you haven't really proven. He's like, well, I have Spawn, and it's been around for a long time. And I'm like, yeah, dude, but it doesn't sell Marvel numbers. Like,
well, he wants the creative control, and Blumhouse is willing to give him $10 million in creative control, and he needs $30 million, so nobody else. Todd's writing that up.
Not that great. A lot of the stuff we like tends to be from other writers. I mean, me personally, mm-hmm. I liked when he had those creator runs. I mm-hmm. thought that shit was great. Mm-hmm. But Todd kind of kicks, he kind of kicks the same dead horse over and over and over and over and over. Wanda. I'm like, I'm waiting for the book to take off a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it's not doing much. Now, granted, we're judging Todd's work from what, almost 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure Todd is sharpened his skills when it comes to writing.
I've read some of the post 300 stuff, and so far it's okay. It's definitely a lot better. I hated the stuff where they had the other guy, the Jim whatever, the preacher guy. I hated that material. But preacher the stuff guy. I've read, yeah, I remember how when Al Simmons got replaced for like 100 issues.
I have not read a Spawn comic in forever, dude. The last Spawn comic I read
the Eric Larson stuff, didn't you?
No,
you didn't read the Eric Larson stuff?
No, I want to.
It's good. He's a good fit for Spawn.
Okay, I'm afraid to read it because you're gonna be like, no, don't get ahead.
It's no,
like,
go ahead and read it, man.
That's like 300, and that's like, you know, 17 years in the future. We're not there yet.
Read all that fucking stuff from like, 250? You can read any of that shit from 250 up if you want to. I've read a chunk of it. I'm going to shut you down and start talking too much about it. But
I read was the one, and I read it by accident, where apparently there's two twin kids and one's evil.
Okay, now, that we're not going to talk about. But yeah, that was good shit too.
Is it?
It's shit like that that makes me go back and try on.
I just remember reading that. I was like, this is kind of cool, but I don't I don't know what's going on. Like, mm-hmm. I felt like, oh shit, I'm gonna have to go back and read all the shit in the past or some way kind of fill in the gaps, because this feels like I walked in the middle of the fucking movie.
Yeah.
So I just walked away and never went back to it. And then you were like, hey, let's do a fucking Spawn podcast on top of the other fucking 20 other podcasts we're doing. I'm like, sure, why not? Fuck it. I ain't got a life. Let's do this. Yeah, I haven't read a Spawn comic in forever, dude.
Yeah.
Like, when I bought that figure, matter of fact, it's from the same dude. When I went to that fucking, that little,
this flea market
pop-up shop or whatever the fuck it was. It literally, dude, was like a Comic Palooza type thing in a parking lot of a fucking restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
But they were selling, like, others. Like, there was, like, a lot of, local artist type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just, you know, support local artists, like, you know, they're having, you know, hard times and stuff. So that's why I went.
Yeah.
And he had a fucking Spawn figure, like one of the new ones,
mm-hmm.
that I saw going for like $25, and he's like $5. I'm like, done, dude. Like, I want a Spawn figure so I can put on my wall. So I do a show. I didn't tell him this shit, but I'm thinking, you know, it'd be nice to kind of have him as a little totem here, like, mm-hmm. to give me his blessings as I'm butchering his book. So he's like, right now, he's literally over the mic right now. He's standing staring at me, judging me and being judged by Spawn. We're gonna do issue 29. This was fucking weirder too, but it was interesting, very interesting. Would you like to describe the cover?
Yeah, that's the thing in and of itself. Spawn is hunched, sort of in a semi Spider-Man pose, but instead of having his arms out, he's got his arms around a little blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy who's crying. From them are chains being shot out at some unseen enemy, and also his cape is in total tatters, and he's basically like got plasma jizz shooting all over the place. And I would swear some of this shit's spelling some sort of words. I feel like it's saying like ace asshole. I don't know. It seems like they're trying to write something in there, but I can't quite make it out.
Trying to Disney it up a little bit, hide it in the background.
Right, right. There's a dick on that tower in Atlantis. Yes, given.
The tree's a penis.
So
Michael Murphy.
Right. Okay. Yeah. The episode's dedicated to Michael. I'm sorry. The issue is dedicated to Michael Murphy. I got no clue. I looked him up on some of the websites. I ran some searches. There's an actor named Michael Murphy you'd be familiar with. He's one of those guys that always pops up and stuff. One of those character actors. I don't know who the hell that's supposed to be though. I can't relate it to anything going on with Spawn.
Okay. I was wondering. I thought you were going to frank me on that one, because I was like, I don't remember reading any Wizard magazines or anything where they brought up some guy named Michael Murphy. So I was like, oh, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah,
okay. So would you like to start us off on it?
Not really. I'll give the credits, though. So this issue was by Todd McFarlane and Greg Capullo, with thanks to Kevin Conrad once again. It's getting to be a regular thing, it seems like. The story is called Father. Issue was released on March the 23rd, 1995, exactly 1 month after the previous issue, so that's nice. To give some context to what was going on around the same time as this issue came out, kind of a momentous period. So Rob Liefeld's Maximum Press began this year, setting the stage for his departure from Image the following year. Over at Valiant, you had Birthquake. Do you remember that? So that's when, you know, they'd always had what they called Nobro at Valiant, where they took some green talent and sort of, you know, built them up like sort of a Ramirez Raiders bullpen kind of situation. So a lot of the people that worked at Valiant in the early years were either, you know, retirees from Marvel or new guys they were training up. So what they did with Birthquake was, I think, I want to say maybe this, they'd already been acquired by Acclaim by that point and were a little bit flush with money. I'm pretty sure that's the case. And so they went out and bought a bunch of they paid for a bunch of talent, mostly from DC Comics, and were, you know, pulling them away. So you had Norm Breyfogel taking on Bloodshot. You had Paul Galassi doing Eternal Warrior. You had Mike Manley on Ninjak. You had Dan Juergens on Solar. Rags Morales was staying on Turok, but that's where he had been. That's right, because he had started out on Black Condor and then he went to Valiant, so that might have been when he was first getting started on Turok. And then of course Bart Sears taking on Exo Manowar, which, as you may remember from previous episodes, was one of the reasons why he didn't finish Violator, as he overcommitted on books like Exo and didn't get that miniseries done. But speaking of DC, the Demon series ended this month, and it makes me wonder why we didn't get more material or any material from guys like Garth Ennis and Warren Ellis at McFarlane Productions. It seems like they'd be a great fit for Spawn material.
Oh, fuck yeah, dude. Especially the way Demon ended. Mm-hmm. That whole last trade, which I still need to get my hands on, was fantastic. Still some of my favorite reads.
Yeah, I'd have loved to have seen him do some stuff with Spawn. on. So Gen 13 started its ongoing series with number one with the 13 different covers, which was a big fucking deal at the time. And all those covers were like speculator, you know, hotness. Ghost in the Shell was starting at Dark Horse. You had Spawn guest starring in Shadowhawk number 17 around this time period. David Latham started Stray Bullets at El Capitan around the same time period. So we're definitely reaching a place where at the mid 90s, the bust has already happened, but you're seeing what we're getting some material that is exciting the fans that are left after the bust, I would say.
Okay.
So some things we missed when we covered the Angela miniseries a few years ago was that Gabrielle files a report telling the External Intelligence Division that the clown was still human and never left Earth, which we now know was another lie on her part. During the miniseries, with a shared panel between them, we see Spawn fall from the sky to land in Florence, Alabama. Since his cape was shot off in Elysium, he could no longer teleport, and since he had been bitten by a vampire in the male bulge, he was deathly ill from a poison. And that's where this issue picks up, right after the end of the Angela miniseries.
Yeah, because I think it mentions that even like issue 3 or some shit like that.
Sure. A note, this story begins where we left Spawn at the close of the Angela miniseries issue 3, Tom. And the Tom is an interesting notion because this book doesn't have an editor. You know, in the early issues, Todd's wife was editing it, but there's no longer a listed editor. So I'm thinking, it says here too, Tom Morzakowski, the longtime letterer of first X-Men and then Spawn, is apparently also the copy editor. So it maybe he was doing a lot of spelling corrections while he was doing the lettering and maybe going in there and doing a little editor's note, which we don't see very often in Spawn, but it was nice and welcome.
Okay.
So what happens in this issue?
So again, that same little blonde, blue-eyed child finds Spawn on the side of the road, bleeding, confused, not sure where he's at, passes out. Child decides that he's going to save him, a la E.T. style, and try to pick him up. And I did like the fact that, you know, the kid's like, you know, can't lift him. And all of a sudden, he's like, wow, you're light as a feather. You know, how the chains are smashing into the ground and pushing the wagon, which I assumed once Spawn got in the wagon, it would just fucking flat out. But apparently the chains are holding him high, distributing his weight enough that the wagon is able to move without Spawn crushing it. And I love the fact that it's describing how like they're digging into the concrete to move. What was the little kid's name?
Do they name him? I'm sure they do.
Timmy or Adolf or whatever the fuck his name is. Like the kid doesn't know that these chains are moving like snakes and pushing the wagon behind them.
So. The boy's name is Andy.
Andy, there we go. Andy.
You know, it's funny. The tendency is obviously to point out the similarities between Spawn and Spider-Man and Venom, which is fair. But one thing that's kind of neat with the way the chains are used in this particular issue is that it's actually more like Dr. Octopus, the way that the chains are helping him carry him along and stuff.
Well, I was thinking almost like Dr. Strange's cape in the new Marvel movie.
Sure, that makes sense.
Like they're almost sentient. They have mind. Maybe not, you know, communication. Well, maybe, I don't know. Like, I guess they know to protect them. And so I guess, well, the fucking symbiote. That's all it is. It's protecting the host. Spawn is the host. So I wonder if the chains in the costume are feeding off his power, like leeches.
I think they've set up over the course of the series. I don't know if they've done so at this point, but in general, that the symbiote is its own thing. It doesn't take power away from Spawn. Because that's why he relies on the symbiote so much as the series progresses, is because he can use that without it costing him any power.
That's true.
So I don't think that it's actually feeding off of him, but obviously they do have that relationship, and the suit is made to protect him, and I think to guide him as well. Then, for once, the rare non-gratuitous butt shot.
Yeah, that was, so the kid's trying to get Spawn back to his house to nurse him back to health, a la E.T. style, and Spawn notices the kid's ass hanging out, and he has like these fucking just gnarly welts or scars, and it's kind of already giving you an idea what this story's like, what direction we're going with this story.
Yeah,
but of course Spawn is not of right mind in their encounter, and Terry trying to get some. I'm feeling for my man. He's trying to get some. It seems like he's gonna slide in there, and then a goddamn kid jumps on a bed.
Mama.
Can't get none. So the kid shows up, of course, you know. Isn't this where he's talking to her, like, you know, let's see.
By the way,
she's kind of telling him, where I really went. And, you know, basically just confessing, you know, I went and checked it out. Almost got killed, got saved, left the picture of the fan. And, you know, I don't know what else to say to that.
No, it's just your connection is bad. So it's mm-hmm. going to be a little tough, because you keep doing like, this thing.
Max headroom.
So the kid jumps in, disrupts Terry and Wanda from some of that sexual healing, and
another license I can't afford.
Or just like hum it,
right?
And so
baby.
At the time, Terry. Terry's picking up, what's the daughter's name?
Saya?
Saya, yeah. At the same time, shit, the little blonde kid, he's being picked up by his father, who's an officer.
And, yeah, they're showing the parallels to the loving relationship versus one, you know.
Abuse. Yeah. And, you know, there's Kurt Cobain in the background, and there's a little kid getting beat by his cop dad. And, I mean, the house is a wreck. You kind of know where this story's going.
Yeah, the older brother's there, right? Eddie?
Yeah. And Eddie tries to jump in to protect his younger brother. The dad smacks him. And, I mean, that is kind of a frightening panel. Seeing his hands about to hit the child, and you see the fist in the child's eyes. Mm-hmm. That kind of bothered me.
Yeah.
That got me a little bit.
Well, like, there's just so much anger in this kid, too. I mean, sorry, there's so much anger in the dad. So much violence in this person.
I have to say, this was the one time that the violence got to me in this book.
Because,
you know, it's geared toward a child. And, you know, usually in the Spawn books, it's punchy, punchy, kicky, kicky. And this one, I was kind of like, it took me a while to get to the next panel. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, I was like, oh, that's really powerful. You know, Todd's really kind of pushing it. And of course, you know, the next moment, Eddie and his little brother sitting there, and the kid's like, oh, it's not too bad. You know, he didn't break any bones. And I'm just like, oh, damn, dude. Like,
well, especially because they've shown this bright, beautiful child. And then when you see him with a fucked up black eye that's all wrinkled out with the trademark missing. McFarlane Capullo detailing, the tooth missing. And so you've got that contrast.
Big Disney doe eye.
Mm-hmm. And the other one's sealed closed because of it. Yeah, the contrast really brings home the brutality.
Yeah. And so, of course, we do have that E.T. moment where he wants to show his brother, where he has E.T., Eddie Torres, in the little shack in the background. And so they're making their way back there. And he shows them, and Spawn is there. And, of course, Spawn, he must be extremely weakened because he can't even, you know, he's telling him, you know, just close the door. And he's saying, please.
Yeah. Oh, well, he's been poisoned by a demon from hell. So, yeah. Huh? He's been poisoned by a demon from hell. So he's not usually in a place that vulnerable.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's saying, please. He's very unspawned.
Uncharacteristically.
He's just more either in charge or he's brooding. And at this point, he's just at the mercy of these kids. And so the kids are like, wow, check it out. And Spawn is sitting there and they're trying to figure out what he is. And he's actually quite polite to them, like, pardon. And I'm assuming because they're children also.
Yeah.
And, he does this whole, you know, he's my personal E.T. Do you like Reese's Pieces? And so he's talking about how his finger glowing, and Spawn's like, my finger was glowing? And so he asked the kid, you know, he starts questioning the kid if he got hit. And of course, you know, the kid's going to play it off. He's already, you know, he's talking about how mom's gone to heaven. And he even has a point to where he starts telling the story where, oh, no, I fell down.
Yeah, we just play lots of tackle football.
Yeah, the stories you hear about this.
Yeah.
I immediately thought about Fight Club when he in the doctor's office, and Tyler tells him, you fell down the stairs. And he looks at the doctor and says, I fell down the stairs. I was just like, oh, that's brutal. At which point, their father wakes up, screams for them, Andy and Eddie to come inside. Bond hears it. They're running in. He's yelling at them, which, of course, I thought was fucked up, having him go to bed early on a fucking Saturday. What a travesty already. Abuse. And so he's telling them how they got church tomorrow. He's making them go to bed, 8 o'clock, because he's going to go to the bar. Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm listening to you. Okay.
And then we go back to Sam and Twitch. Yeah, this is where they talk about the hiring of Kincaid. We were talking about it earlier.
Mm-hmm. It does tend to run together a little bit. Yeah. As usual, Twitch is the perceptive one. And he points out, while they're looking at the dossier again, you know, sir, some of the info contained in this file is eyes-only stuff. No one but high-ranking operatives of certain government agencies would have access to any of it. And Sam's like, meaning our little red-caped hero must be a disgruntled government boy. That's our first potential lead on him. So you can see a little bit of investigative on their part, as opposed to just like showing up at the right place at the right time and shooting somebody.
True. Or shooting, Twitch is a bit of a sniper.
Yes, he is. They made that clear. He's supposed to be ex-military too, isn't he?
Is he?
I thought so.
I don't remember that part. And so they're discussing the case, and of course the chief comes in and starts yelling at Burke. But Burke now has this smug attitude toward him and a smug face because he knows he has him over the barrel. And so he's just kind of walking off, and to the point where he just walks off, and it just sets the chief off. And of course the chief is threatening them because they're doing something off the books. What is that, 80s detective trope? I guess who would be Rigg?
Definitely Sam is. Well, no, because Twitch is the one who's good with shooting and stuff. So I he would kind of be the one taking points. So I guess he's sort of the Riggs. Because Sam's more of the Murtaugh, where he's like, you know, I'm too old for this shit.
I'm too old for this
shit. Except in his cases, I'm too fat for this shit. Give me another donut.
Hey.
No,
so, of course, Spawn is sitting there.
Well, but before you go to that, I want to point out, this page is interesting to me because, you know, sometimes I'll bring up how I don't necessarily always bring up, like, like the inker or the letterers, things like that. And I think it's interesting looking at these panels. It's clear that this must be another instance of Kevin Conrad. I'm confident that Kevin Conrad must have inked this page because it does not look like either. Again, it doesn't look like Capullo. It doesn't look like McFarlane. It's definitely got its own vibe to it. It's consistent enough for the other pages. But if you're looking for it at all, you'll see that this is a different style of inking. And Orzechowski's really doing a lot of stuff with the lettering too. He's making sure that the lettering is acting for these key characters, and you see where the real shouting's going on and where they're leaning into words and stuff. So this is a curious instance where my eye is really drawn to the inker and the letterer, which is not what you'd normally expect in a comic book.
Okay. Our next panel, we find them at the church. They're praying.
Them being the dad and the kids.
Well, the dad and the kids, of course. And the whole community has a high view of the father. They put him on a pedestal because he's helping out about tickets, and his kids are well-mannered. They're a little banged up, but he's like, hey, you know, kids, you know, they're always playing rough. They're not playing. And so you get that whole thing where it's one of those, you don't know really what's going on underneath the exterior of their lives. And we catch the father having a beer with several next to him. He tells the young one to go get a beer. Beer breaks, and of course he goes to grab the kid. Now, I did find this scene kind of fucked up, where he's kind of grabbing the kid, he's throwing him around,
choking him, got him on a chokehold.
Choking him. Yeah, I mean, they did not shy away from the violence.
Yeah, well, and you've got the letterer really emphasizing how much he's just screaming at the top of his lungs, this poor kid. And they make the big point of this being the last beer. And since they've already set it up that this is Sunday, they were coming back from church, you know, this is a dry county and he can't get any more beer. So that was literally the last beer that he could get. Now, I'm sure as a cop, he could find somebody who would sell him a beer on a Sunday.
He's going to the bar. He says he's going to the pub at the end. But the fact that he puts the gun by his head and pulls the trigger and laughs about it was just, that panel was pretty disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I mean, it was a powerful, it's a powerful image. The lettering is amazing. The coloring, everything about it is just dark, really dark. Of course, then we come to, you know, where Andy's kind of telling his brother, you know, he's getting worse.
Yeah. You got that panel too, where his nose is running, his eyes are running like faucets, and the kid's clearly terrified, and it's totally manipulative. It's the easiest thing in the world. You're going to beat a kid. You're going to get a rise out of people over that. But also, you're emotionally engaged in a Spawn comic, which isn't always the case. And if it takes that type of manipulation to draw you in, yes, I want to see Spawn fuck this dude's dad, this dad up. You know, that you're invested.
Well, hold on. You're getting ahead of yourself there now. And so, you know, Spawn walks in. What happened? Just from what he's seen, he's already pieced it together, and he decides that he's going to take care of it himself.
But the kids are still fighting him in the sense of trying to defend their dad.
Please don't hurt him. Now, this is the part that I thought was kind of fucked up. The next scene, we go from Andy's eyes to Wanda's eyes, where she sees Spawn. She sits up. Apparently, Terry was trying to get some, and he got cock-blocked by Spawn.
I don't know if that's the case. The fact that she's lying in bed, seemingly topless, I think that this is post. I think that they probably passed out, and she's waking up from the dream.
I think they were just revving up to get to it, and Spawn popped in her head, and she freaked out and stopped it. Because it just, I don't know. She's talking about, you know, him tearing those guys apart in front of her.
Mm-hmm. She keeps seeing visions of that. Yeah.
Seen in her head. Yeah. And how he's a monster. There's nothing human about him. It's, you know.
Well, they keep doing those parallels, and you cut to the next page, and it's a splash of Spawn hugging the boys as they're crying and trying to console them and telling them he's going to make things better. So you've got that contrasting, which is nice, and it is an authorial thing. You know, that's a writing thing. That's a storytelling thing. Todd's trying to do better, and I respect that.
Yeah, he's learning. I mean, he's learning. So yeah, again, this image is another powerful image where she sees him one way, but actually he is very human. He feels for these kids. He wants to help them in some way, but of course his ways are very violent and pretty much ends in death. So he decides he's going to take care of it some way. The father or the officer is coming out of a bar. He grabs him, drags him into an alleyway, and decides that he's going to punish him somehow. Now at this part, when I read this panel and he's talking about if you get into the habit, you might find yourself hitting someone you love, like I did, regretting it forever. So did he hit Wanda once?
Yeah, I'm confident that that's what they're showing here, is that his violence extended to Wanda.
And I was like, is that him striking Wanda? Because I always imagine Spawn as like a puppy dog, that he was so madly in love with Wanda.
Mm-hmm.
And then to hear that, wait, he struck her?
Mm-hmm.
Like, fucking, what happened there? Like, that was really strange to think that for someone who would come crawling out of hell for her, now is she more like property? Like, he wants her back because because she belongs to him?
I don't know if that's the case. I think it's more complicated than that.
Is it really love or is it ownership? Like, I mean, he struck her. I couldn't imagine striking someone I love.
They found a love in a hopeless place.
I was thinking more of Smack of Love.
Mm.
And she'll come back with a sixer. And so I don't know if they're going to, like, I can't remember that far back if they're going to deep dive into that
moment situation. Of violence. Yeah,
I'm just curious, like, what happened there? Because I really, honestly, that scene, seeing that, I questioned, was it really love he came back for, or is it something else?
Yeah, and the thing is, they will address that in the future, but it's in the far future, and okay. So I don't want to get too much into that, but I mean, under normal circumstances, I'd be like, well, is that Wanda, or what's going on there? I'm very conscious of a moment that happens years from this point that addresses that during the David Hine run, so it's a ways off.
And so he decides he's going to punish him somehow. And so it's one of those, it's a twist moment. He, you know, does all Twilight Zone on him, teleports him. The officer is coming out of the alleyway. Again, I found this part a little disturbing.
You've got a great couple of kids here and they need a father. It's time you started acting like one. A lot of people have good feelings about you, Joe. It's time the two most important ones felt the same way. End of sermon. Now I want to leave a little reminder for you. A message for everyone who talks about what a great guy you are. If you're good, it'll fade in a month.
And so Andy and Eddie come home one day. Andy sees his wagon smashed and his shirt, his brother's favorite shirt, torn up. And of course the officer has "I beat my kids" tattooed all over his body. Now, what did Bond think was going to happen? I mean, I was really caught off guard by this ending. I didn't remember this ending. I'm pretty sure I read this comic, but I don't remember this ending where the dad attacks the kids and Eddie goes for the gun and he's trying to save his brother and the father tells him, you know, I told you never to, was it? He tells him, get off him, I mean it. How many times have I told you that thing's not a toy? And the kid's like, I know. And then blam. So Bond still destroyed everything around him.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't make anything better. He made it. I don't know. It's a tough toss up. Yeah. Did he make it worse?
Well, I mean, he put a preteen boy in a position to have to murder his father with his own gun, seemingly, because it's not confirmed too.
And who knows? I mean, the brothers are going to be separated. One might go into foster care.
Well, and we're assuming that they kill the dad. That's not necessarily the case. We see a blam, again, really nice little lettering effect, because the silhouette of the house against the stark red sky is inside the letters BLAM, and then everything goes white and you just see some blood splotch. So there's a safe assumption that somebody got shot, but we don't know for certain who it is who got shot. What we do know is that Spawn, once again, used violence to try to solve a situation, didn't stick around to see what that violence did in his wake, which is something we're seeing with Wanda too. You know, he saves her from the rapists, but he's traumatized her with the images of these guys getting broken to pieces by Spawn. And so is he doing more harm than good? And I think that that's an intentional theme on Todd McFarlane's part.
That's a running theme through the whole book. Yeah. No matter what he can never use his power for good.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, no, you know, it's that whole, the three wishes or monkey paw.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what he does, it turns to shit at the end.
Yeah.
I can't think of one time where he did something good and it turned out okay in the end. Like somebody walked away.
Well, and again, we've talked about this a lot in recent episodes where I'll be like, he's so passive. He never does anything. Get off your ass and get something done, Spawn. And we see when he does try to do something, he's a fucking jinx. You know, it's like he just makes everything worse. It's almost like there's something evil about him there's a reason why he went to hell in the first place, right? If he were such a good guy, then he wouldn't have had Malbolgia there to give him a deal. So maybe he's just a guy who fucks everything up. You know, he just doesn't know the right way to handle things and he just makes everything worse. And maybe it's a good thing that he spends so much time looking at pictures in Spawn Alley.
I mean, he's basically the living representation of what? The all good intentions or a road to hell.
Yeah it really is. So
everything he does leads to ruin. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking the last few issues we've read and I'm like, I can't think of anything he's done where, I mean, he throws Angela's life into chaos when he saves her. Like, I've been trying to think, has he done anything good for anybody
that made the wise? But I mean, he saved Terry, but he put Terry in danger in the first place because he's the one who stole the guns and it fell onto Terry. So if he hadn't been around to steal the guns, he wouldn't have to have saved Terry.
But now Terry's running around like a whipped dog.
Yeah, he's definitely been traumatized by that experience as well. There's just a lot of damage in this dude's way.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a very interesting take with this character. Like, I'm starting to see layers like an onion. No, dude, they came out, what, 20-some years ago?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that you would went home and you'd watch it with Pussycat and shit.
I've seen a lot of animation since then.
Okay.
I mean, I went to a local thrift store and I found the, I guess I gave, didn't I give you like a Spawn collection I had?
You gave me a DVD. Yeah, I was like,
I found a DVD box, a tin can box that has like all of it in there. I just haven't cracked it open. I've been meaning to watch them just because I want to rewatch them to see if they hold up as well as they did back then when I watched them.
Well, at some point, we're going to do it here on the show. It's just that there hasn't been a good opportunity. Like episode 25 would have been good, but we did the Image Zero for that one and all the other stuff. So I've been waiting for some sort of an anniversary to be like, you know, do at least the first season and then go from there.
I mean, yeah, we could definitely do a show on it.
But it's funny. I watched 2 3/4 seasons of Spawn on HBO. They had it on demand. I think it was HBO Now. And because I was starting to lose the thread on what was happening on the third season and how it was going to relate to what we did on our show, and it didn't have, especially once you get into the later seasons, it doesn't really have anything to do with the comics. It gets into all that Japanese stuff and everything, and it's like, let me come back to this, and then I never got back to it. And so then I've watched them again recently because I wanted to get sound clips of Chapel for the episodes we were doing. But I've never quite finished the series, but I got so, like, literally like an episode or two short of finishing out the entire series, and instead I'm going to watch it all over again for one of the podcasts in the future. But that's on HBO Max, thankfully. But you know, like, the only thing I've watched on Peacock since we got Peacock, and we didn't pay for it, we got the free version. Have you downloaded that yet, Peacock?
No.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what devices it's on, so that could be a problem too, because I know a lot of the newer ones aren't on all the different devices. The only freaking thing I've watched on Peacock to any degree is Savage Dragon.
Oh, I saw that on YouTube. I watched the whole series. You kind of got me hooked, and I watched all of Savage Dragon, all of Wildcat, and Cadillac and Dinosaurs.
Savage Dragon is pretty good. it's pretty fun.
Held up pretty well. Yeah. I like the voice actor.
I really don't like the guy who does Savage Dragon's voice.
It should have been an adult cartoon though, because of Savage Dragon content. Mm. But for the most part, yeah, I liked it. I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
It took me back to, you know, sitting at home watching this shit on a Saturday morning cartoon. It was just really weird to watch it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's nice, I did watch some of the clips. I don't know that you watched on YouTube unless you found something like some dark web area of YouTube. I mostly was able to find those kind of cartoons on Dailymotion, and there used to be a site that specialized in cartoons. I think it was some Russian site, and I don't know if it's around anymore because I can't find it again. But what's nice about the Peacock versions is they're not sped up or altered in any weird ways. Yeah. But it does, the guy who does the voice for Savage Dragon, his pitch is a little too high for me. It kind of bugs me. I thought that was going to get corrected, but when watching the legit versions, and it's like, no, his voice is just not really what I would want it to be.
Right now, I'm watching the Rusty and Big Guy.
Yeah, I forgot. How long did that run?
Huh?
I forgot that existed. How long did that run?
Dude, it's a fantastic animation. Fantastic. I mean, I honestly, I've never read the books. Was it a book or was it just an art book?
It was a book. They did, not a ton
like
of stories.
Like a giant-sized book, right?
Yeah, I think they might have done like a treasury or something with it because they were wanting to showcase the detail that Jeff Darrow put in the artwork. But they didn't.
I remember going to a Comic Palooza and found the puzzle, and this guy was selling it for like $3. I'm like, dude, this thing's it's an amazing piece of art. And he had like the complete puzzle unopened.
Mm-hmm.
So I owned that. Fryhole had bought me the Rusty and Big Guy animation series at some con one time. And so when I work out in my garage now, I'm like, man, what do I put into what? You know, I usually watch a movie when I work out just to time myself. And I put it in and I catch myself watching like 5 episodes. It's a pretty good show. So
that's one of those. I'm not enough of a Dark Horse guy. That's one of the areas where I think you're deeper into Dark Horse and to Valiant than I ever was.
My Dark Horse goes as deep as like Rusty Big Guy, maybe Aliens and Predator. Well, I did try to read a Flaming Carrot comic one time because I was like, ooh, let me try to read something indie and edgy. And it was really fucking weird. Concrete. Oh, yeah, I do. Yeah, I did read quite a bit of
Hellboy.
Hellboy. Yeah, I never thought about that. Yeah, I did read. So I was reading independent book before.
Actually,
I used to bust my balls about that when we were first hanging out, how I just read nothing but Marvel and you were the DC fanboy.
Well, and Martial Law was briefly at Dark Horse too.
Was it? No, it was Epic.
No, is it Dark? I mean, I'm saying it's gone to a lot of publishers, but they did the Evil Dead for the sequel. Cape Fear, I think it was called. They did the one with the Legion of Superheroes.
Sure?
The two-parter.
I'm pretty sure they're all through Epic, man.
Now, Dark Horse, Epic didn't even exist anymore by that point, or was on its way out. Dark Horse, like the Hateful Dead was done at what was the name of the company that they'd formed? Armageddon or Apocalypse or something?
Apocalypse. You're right. Apocalypse. Yeah. Apocalypse.
And then the second half of that, the conclusion, Super Babylon is what it was called. That was published by Dark Horse, so the second part
you're
of
right,
that.
You're right. You're right. You're
uh,
the second part is
the Mask crossover was done at Dark Horse.
That's true.
The
Hellraiser one.
I think the Hellraiser one might have actually been at Epic. That was actually, before Epic closed. And then the two parter with the Legion of Superheroes versus the Alien Xenomorphs, that was at Dark Horse.
Well, they did the Savage Dragon in Martial Law.
Yeah, but that was an Image, if I remember correctly. It might have been
Spawn era. Dude, I think Spawn and Martial Law would have been a really good crossover.
I don't know though, because I mean they're kind of too similar in the both, neither one of them buys into the superhero bullshit. They're both like, you know, military guys and people who basically kick your ass and a little bit
But Martial Law would so try to kill him because he's a costume.
No, because he's not a superhero. He's very reactive. He's not proactive. He's got the whole Charles Barkley I'm not a role model thing going on. I really don't think that Martial Law would give a shit about Spawn.
That's a good point.
You know, and again, they're both military guys. You know, they're both gun guys. Neither one of them is trying to like, I don't know. I think they actually kind of would get along. They're not that dissimilar. Obviously, you know, Joe Gilmore is a lot more aggressive and a lot more proactive, but I honestly think that he'd probably feel bad for him because he is still a homeless person at the end of the day. And, you know, he's not trying to enforce his will on anybody. He just wants to be left the fuck alone. You know, I don't see the it'd be tricky to do the story there. We are way fucking off topic though. So hold on, let me see where we can pick this shit back up. I don't even know where we were at anymore. I would have liked to have seen a Bloodstrike spinoff cartoon, and probably it's funny. I think it's really insightful. I hadn't really considered it, but I do like the Wildstorm universe, and there is, you know, where we will eventually get to Wildstorm. It's just that since Extreme is so much more closely tied to the Spawn than Wildstorm, we kind of have to do the Extreme stuff. But I think one of the reasons why I like Extreme more than average people, and why, which is weird too, because I would normally be the kind of person who would criticize a lot of the Liefeld type of stuff, but because I'm a horror guy too, and that doesn't get as much play because I'm so much about the comic book stuff and everything else, but I really love horror, and I love the mingling of superheroes and horror, which a lot of people don't like. And so probably that's part of why I like Extreme, is because they do play around with a lot of gore and horror stuff that isn't as commonly seen in other superhero universes.
Wait, when Stormwatch got wiped out by aliens, was that part of Image still, or?
Yes, it was still an Image, but you remember too, that being in Wildstorm was something of a turning point, because Wildstorm didn't go that dark or that brutal that often. It really started with Alan Moore. Yeah, that was Warren Ellis, and I think that Warren Ellis sort of brought an extreme mentality into Wildstorm, because certainly the liberties that Mark Miller took with the Authority afterward were more in the vein of the kind of stuff that Alan Moore was pulling on the Extreme universe before that, and Keith Giffen was doing a lot of that type of stuff that was introduced into Wildstorm by Ellis and Miller later on. So I think that maybe the Extreme stuff of the earlier 90s was sort of the beta test for what the British writers and creators were going to do with Wildstorm in the late 90s and early 2000s. We had our Youngblood Yearbook, episode 21, Tumblr, liked and reblogged by Bush007. Our Tumblr for the Spawn 25 episode was liked by Flare Joe, Franjo, Gutierrez Art, S Seals 618, Supreme Being 24, and reblogged by Flare Joe. On Facebook, we were liked by Michael Wagner. On Twitter, we got that Spawning Ground love from 20th Century Geek Podcast, 108 Sage, Adriano, Ale, Alex Chung, Baby Skeletor, Biko Django, CH, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, Colin is Writing, Comic Book Couples Counseling, Doc Strange, Dr. Pop Culture BGSU, Edward Hui, Ed Moore, Fade Out Podcast, Fan Holes Podcast, Green Lantern HG Fighting the Good Fight, HC Ogden, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Hulkling, Hashtag, Black Lives Matter, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jason Snickvenable, Jocktastico, Keith G. Baker, King's Size Comics, Giant Size Fun, Christados, Luke Giaconetti, Hashtag Earth Destruction Directive, Michael Wagner, Mike at Send Aliens to Us, Mix Jeffrey Brown, Nuka Carl Quantum, Relieved Citizen, Mr. Farrell, Reverend Odell Abner Dracula, Schlocktopus Incorporated, Siskoid, Sue Kent Ant, Talk Nerdy to Me, Tim Price the Pod Crasher, Trekker Talk, Tuck, Under the Influence, and Zendal 42. And I'm trying to get these honorariums down. If you weren't aware, Mix is a gender gender-neutral variation on, you know, Mr. and Miss, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly. It was a new one for me in the recent reader-listener feedback sections. So Jeffrey Brown wrote of the Shadowhawk 2 episode, "Ooh, this is exciting. Now this is exciting." Kyle Binning wrote, "Great episode." Michael Wagner said, "Another great episode. Enjoy the time and effort you put into these episodes." And Odell wrote, "Not Spawn related, but the project I finished during this episode, sand and repaint the bookcase I hauled off of the curb. Who thinks I should draw a sick Shadowhawk on the side of this bookcase once I get it in my home office? Also, how much disgust would you expect such shenanigans would rouse in my wife's ire?" Have you had a chance to listen to that episode yet?
Nuh-uh.
I found an audio CD, and basically what happened is Jim Valentino had hired a Houston-based company to do a audio presentation of the Shadowhawk 2 miniseries. So you've got actors reading the lines, you've got sound effects, you've got music. There are several musical interludes. And so I intermixed that with a discussion I had with Matt. So if you haven't checked it out, you ought to check it out. It's pretty cool.
Okay, I'll check it out.
Sawate. My name is Stella, and I am the host of Backroll to Oracle, the Barbara Gordon podcast. Backroll to Oracle is a podcast dedicated to Barbara Gordon, the first woman to hold the mantle of Backroll for an extended period of time, roughly 1967 to 1988. The goal of Backroll to Oracle is to examine the character's history from her first appearance as Backroll and continuing through her tenure as Oracle. Each episode looks at a vintage issue of Detective Comics or Batman, as well as other books like Justice League and Freedom Fighters, and modern issues of Batgirl and Birds of Prey. I also keep track of news involving Batgirl and other members of the Bat family, and I have a revolving series of segments like Babs in the Tube, which highlights appearances of Babs in TV and film, Shipper Spotlight, which looks at a variety of comic and pop culture couples, gives their history, and determines whether they are hot or not, Reading with Stella, which could be described as an audio drama, or just me reading a book that relates to Babs or doesn't, and of course, the mainstay literature recommendation. I have been blessed to interview writers Scott Beatty and Chuck Dixon on their Backroll Year One work, Brian Q. Miller on his Backroll run, Dwayne Swierczynski and Christy Marks on their separate Birds of Prey work, and the creators and actors of the Backroll Spoiled, the web series. I hope to interview more creators and actors in the future. My goal, most importantly, is to make a fun, entertaining, and thoughtful show that people enjoy and from which they learn. Find the show online at thebatmanuniverse.net and iTunes, and follow the show on Facebook and Twitter at Backroll to Oracle. Thank you, and fly on, Babs lovers.
To confront the ultimate killers, I must construct the ultimate alias.
Hey, who is that lady? I think she could fly.
To combat the murderers who destroy my family, crush my own life on their way to consuming everything, I must become a greater, more fearsome destroyer.
Hey, man, somebody killed this lady.
To track down the animals who prey on the innocent, I must stalk them first. I am no longer their quarry. I am the Huntress.
You can listen to The Huntress Podcast online at thehuntresspodcast.com, at Apple Podcasts. Go to Twitter at Huntress Podcast. And again, this shares a feed with the Batgirl Cassandra Cain Podcast. Cheers.
Dinah Lance is a fighter, and her one-woman war is against the czars of crime, the frightened men who dread the blonde bombshell, otherwise known as Black Canary. Writer Robert Kaniger and artist Carmine Infantino created Black Canary in 1947. She debuted as a masked femme fatale that kind of skirted the law, but pretty quickly she evolved into a civic-minded crime fighter. She has mastered multiple martial arts disciplines and unarmed combat forms. Her canary cry, when properly focused, is powerful enough to punch a hole through a wall. Black Canary has, in one form or another, been part of multiple incarnations of the Justice League, the Justice Society, and Birds of Prey. I freaking fell in love with Black Canary, and I'm proud to podcast about her adventures in comics and television. Flowers and Fishnets, a Black Canary podcast.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!